I mean, what strikes me is every problem this team has faced, whether it is health care, the Russia case, the executive orders that came out too quickly and got struck down by the courts, every problem so far has been a self-inflicted wound.
Welcome to Foreign Policy. I'm David Rothkopf, CEO and editor, and you're listening to The ER. I'm in Washington today, and I'm joined by Susan Hennessy, who is a fellow in national security in governance studies at Brookings. She is also managing editor of the Lawfare blog. And David Sanger, national security correspondent for The New York Times and author of Confront and Conceal, Obama's Secret Wars and Surprising Use of American Power. And calling in from Palo Alto is Corey Shockey, a research fellow at the Hoover Institution, where she focuses on military history. Have an idea? Email us at erpodcast@foreignpolicy.com. We may turn the idea into a podcast. You may get a mug. Almost anything could happen. Why don't you write us at that address? Or you can just write to say hello. We love to get email. It makes us feel like we're not alone in this big, vast universe.
Podcast studio.
Podcast studio, exactly. Recently, in our tiny podcast studio, high above Washington's DuPont Circle, we had the following conversation. And this conversation is going to pick up on an earlier conversation in which we were talking about Russia, Russiagate, and potential outcomes. And we talked a little bit in the prior broadcast to the best case scenario for Trump, and we talked a little bit to a likely case. Now, there's another likely case here that we didn't talk about, and that one has to do with the business ties between Trump and Russians, between Kushner, his son-in-law, and Russians, and between other people in his team and Russians, whether it's Wilbur Ross and the Bank of Cyprus or others. And it seems that at some point in this, if we are going to get to the bottom of the nature of Russian influence, we are going to have to look at each of the potential sources of Russian influence. One is the aspirations of the Trump team to get Trump elected. But another is long-term relationships built around business deals upon which people like Trump or Kushner develop dependencies on people in Russia, or at least felt as though the people in Russia had some kind of leverage. Susan, talk to us about the state of play on this particular discussion.
Yeah, so this is like the big unanswered question, and it's part because, you know, Donald Trump has not produced his tax returns. He hasn't produced any kind of basic financial transparency, so it's really hard to understand what his deals look like. Look, I think the broad suspicion here is that because of his multiple bankruptcies, Donald Trump has not been able to secure lines of credit from traditional sources, and therefore he has secured lines of credit from non-traditional sources, including potentially sources in Russia. That kind of leverage, especially if Donald Trump is over-leveraged, right, so they can actually bankrupt him or financially ruin him in some way, creates a situation not only in which, you know, Trump is incentivized to sort of do favors, but in which he's actively afraid of these people. I think the sort of the broader questions and suspicions, and they extend well beyond Russia, you know, right, to Trump, you know, organization conduct contacts in China. There was sort of this rather stunning New Yorker story regarding a hotel deal in Azerbaijan that looks like it might have been sort of tied to Iranian Revolutionary Guard, right? So sanctioned individuals that details sort of at length the personal involvement of Ivanka Trump, among other people, right? So there's sort of these shady business dealings all over the place.
And there's no way to do a hotel deal in Azerbaijan that isn't corrupt.
Yes, right?
Or a deal. Why does it have to be a hotel?
Right. That's right. He's done business in a lot of places where the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act was not, you know, looked up to as a model of good behavior.
Right. So that actually, it creates two different types of leverage, right? So there's actually the financial leverage that whether or not you want to prevent a bad financial outcome or just have a better financial relationship moving forward or sort of sustain your business interests. It also raises the specter that there are people in foreign countries that are aware of your business engaging in criminal conduct, right? A lot of businesses say, you know, their criticism of the FCPA, the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, is it's not possible to not violate it, right? You you know, you can't do business in these places. That is a separate kind of leverage. Ordinarily, it's sort of, it's not fair to smear people with, you know, just the cloud of, well, maybe that's what it is. But whenever you're the president of the United States and sort of all of our destinies are tied to your interests, and we've vested you with this enormous amount of trust, and at the same time, you, your family, your sort of cronies haven't provided any level of transparency, any level of sort of basic accountability, I do think that we're going, that is going to end up being a really, really substantial and significant part.
Well, in fact, they've gone a step further. It's not just that they haven't provided transparency. It's that they've actively lied about it. Trump says, I have no dealings in Russia. And then, you know, you discover that his son actually was on the record saying, oh, no, we have plenty of dealings in Russia. And of course, there's a lot of evidence of those dealings. He says, I don't talk to Russians. And then there's pictures of him with Russians, et cetera, et cetera. And you know, I think the same can be said of Manafort and other people in his orbit who said, oh, I didn't do this. But yet there seems to be evidence that they did do it. One of the things, the specters that's raised by what you talk about there, Susan, though, is that the real leverage the Russians has is not some videotape of Trump, you know, in flagrante with hookers someplace, but that it may be worse as far as Trump is concerned, which is that there are people there who can say that he's actually unendowed financially.
I see what you did there.
Thank you. And that you know that there
it was subtle, but it got a laugh out of Corey.
Yeah. But
was that pure genius, Corey?
It was a really nice hit.
Thanks. But you know, so that's the point, right? Is that there are a bunch of Russians who are kind of the financiers of last resort. You don't go to these guys because Goldman is banging at your door saying, we want to give you a lot of money. You go to these guys because you're about to go bankrupt and they're going to cut a crappy deal and they're going to hold it over your head. And he was dealing with those guys, I think. Isn't that right, David?
Well, we haven't seen much evidence yet of him actually investing in Russia, but we've seen a lot of evidence of Russians investing in his properties, including just buying up apartments in Trump Tower and
when they
elsewhere.
Weren't selling them to Chinese spies and some of the other people.
Some of the others who were, well, you know, they're creating their own version of the United Nations there. You should think of it in the most positive of terms.
Yeah.
Look, my view of the Russian activity out here is, and as somebody who does a lot of fishing, as you know, David, is that the Russian approach here is basically drop 1,000 hooks, each one baited, into the water, because sooner or later you're going to have 2 or 3 bites on there that will come up to be useful to you. And that's why every time there's a prominent American who goes to Russia, they clean out their computers. Don't bring your regular computer to Russia, a little modern cyber hint, or your phone. You know, it'll all be cleaned out. And I suspect that in years ago when Trump would come, they knew nothing more than he was a prominent, loud real estate developer who might have influence.
Vulgar, right? Badly educated, inarticulate. Very limited grasp on the policy. Oh, sorry.
But,
go on. I didn't mean
to. But useful to them, perhaps. And they did what they did with everyone else. It's just that if you do this with 1,000 people, one of them may end up becoming president of the United States one day. And so, you know, what you've gotten to is the core of, is there anything in the Russia dossier, the Steele, the former MI6 agent's dossier? And, you know, some of it may be true and some of it may not be. But the fact of the matter is that on those times that Trump went to Russia, he left a wide digital path. And so there are all these issues out there, and his own failure, as Susan put out, to go release his taxes and talk about this or fully divest in all of his business interests simply keeps the cloud over his head. And the fear is that if this just keeps going on, then it overshadows everything else he may want to go do. Now, if you're somebody who wants to see Donald Trump tied up on the world stage— unable
is
to
that
go
in those videos too.
That I haven't seen the video. If that's the case, then there are a lot of people who are in favor of this, and that is essentially the White House argument that the Russia stuff is being promoted by people who just want to keep the attention on this and don't want to let him go do the other things he was going to go do in the world.
Corey, do you think that these ethical issues, these compromising financial ties, are likely to materialize as a problem for a Trump administration? Or alternatively, is the Trump administration proving that Americans don't really care about this stuff so long as presidents get things done?
You pose a terrific dilemma, David. It has been so alarming for me to see my fellow Republicans giving the president a lot of latitude on things that if a Democrat did, we would be howling from the rooftops about. And the shift in attitudes towards Russia following Donald Trump's excuses about Russia's bad behavior has been genuinely shocking. On the conservative side, I remain hopeful, though, that when we see things like the protests across Russia over the weekend and the detention of Alexei Navalny, the Russian campaigner, political campaigner, and other Russian behavior, that my fellow Republicans will be shocked back into a reminder that we oppose violations of human rights and human dignity, that we oppose authoritarianism. I have asked myself for the last year or so whether there is any plausible justification other than personal or financial beholdenness to the Russian mafia, to the Russian state, although those are largely the same thing, to Russian investors in his business, whether there is any alternative explanation for Donald Trump's attitudes about Russia. And I can come up with one. I don't know whether it is accurate, but I'll tell you what it is, and I'll give you one piece of supporting data. My potential theory is that not that Donald Trump is so deeply compromised to Russia that he is always making excuses for Russians, but that at a primordial level, somewhere in his mind, there is a notion that actually foreign policy realists would support, which is that getting us out of the business of great power confrontation is a good thing for the security of the United States. Moreover, it is a defensible choice. Eisenhower was much less confrontational towards the Soviet Union than Republicans of his day would have been if anyone other than him had been the candidate. So maybe Trump has, again, I wouldn't say a well-developed or acknowledged theory of great power interaction, but maybe he does at some level understand that maybe the United States would be safer if we tried to find common ground with the Russians and the Chinese. And that's where I get to the corroborating data, because his attitudes towards the Chinese don't look to me to be materially different than his attitudes towards the Russians. And maybe his extended family has the same kind of tawdry, corrupt business relationships with the Chinese that they do with the Russians. And something about Jared Kushner's behavior suggests that they might. But maybe they're not as extensive as in Russia or Turkey or other places where they're looked to be deeply problematic. Maybe he's got a theory of great power relations.
Yeah, that's possible. The other thing he might have a theory of that's similarly possible is unifying quantum theory with the rest of physics and solving a problem that have been challenging the greatest minds of physics for the past 100 years. Susan, you would like to say something.
I didn't say it was likely, David.
I sort of question the idea that he has, that there's not a meaningful distinction between his views on China and those on Russia, right? He actually, we know that sort of rhetoric and instinct is such a big part of Trump's sort of persona and political sensibilities. He has sort of done this tough talk on China.
Oh, yeah.
And, we saw that he was, the quintessential paper tiger and backing off of the disavowing the one China policy. But it does appear as though he has rather different instincts in terms of wanting to push back or sort of be seen as aggressive and critical and strong in a way that we have never heard him talk that way about the Russians.
Well, part of the difficulty that we're facing here is that we've had nobody sort of sit down and explain the Trump worldview of superpower relations. And it's hard to imagine here for a moment that if you looked at this from the outside, you'd say, I want to invest over the long term in our relationship with Russia, and I want to divest in our relationship with the rising power of China. It would seem on a pure economic scale that China would be the place where you would want to go work out the relationship the most. And in fact, it's President Xi who's coming to Mar-a-Lago early next month, and that'll be the first time that we have seen conversations between President Trump and President Xi. And it's possible that President Trump may come to the conclusion that he really can't do anything with Russia for all the reasons we've discussed before, and that he's going to have to gradually change his view on China. I wouldn't be surprised if a couple of years from now, that's actually where we end up. But it's going to take him a long time to dig out of the China hole of the campaign and get to that. And it's going to take some work on the part of the Chinese on both trade issues and North Korea and a little of the South China Sea so that China does not appear to be playing the adversary role.
Yeah, I mean, it's striking to me that we're grappling for a great powers theory out of Donald Trump whenever we haven't first addressed the basic issue of finances, in part because we've seen that Donald Trump has been motivated over the totality of his life primarily by personal financial interests. And so that's the sort of the I do think people want to find sort of some explanation or unifying theory here, but I worry that relieves pressure on the sort of the Occam's razor, the most kind of basic and most supported by evidence theory of why Trump acts the way he does. My pet issue here is that I think Congress is hiding behind sort of a collective action issue, like, oh, well, who could possibly get his tax returns? There are two members of Congress that could literally write a letter and get Donald Trump's tax returns. Orrin Hatch and Kevin Brady. Kevin Brady is the chair of the House Ways and Means Committee. Orrin Hatch is the chair of the Senate Committee on Finance and the Joint Committee on Taxation. Literally, get those tax returns, come to the public, explain that you don't believe that he's motivated by financial interests or vouch for whatever you see, and then we can have a conversation about how exactly he views the structure of great world powers. Until then, I just I continue to sort of stubbornly cling to this belief that it seems like Donald Trump is pretty much just in it for himself.
By the way, Susan is exactly right.
That's your mug.
That's what we need on the next set of mugs.
The next set of mugs. But Susan is exactly right. And the reality is that if Donald Trump sought a defense and had the goodwill of the Republicans on the Hill, he could go to one of those guys, or they could do it, and they could say, I looked at the tax returns, there's nothing there, or something else, and defend him. And they don't. So that's, that's another issue. So look, in the remaining time, I'd like to go beyond this, but in the same vein. Because, Susan brought up something, and Susan's actually written about this before. Trump has dealings all around the world. In many places where it's almost impossible to do a deal without violating the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, without breaking U.S. laws, without doing things that are unseemly or partnering with unseemly people. And indeed, we have seen that in other countries and other circumstances, he has partnered with, or his company has partnered with felons. They've partnered with government regimes that have very odious track records, et cetera. Why is it that we are not reading more about different cases like this in different places? Why is the New York Times so lazy that they do not send all these reporters they have out to cover this stuff when, in fact, there ought to be not one, but dozens of stories about this, because for sure it's there. If only foreign policy were big enough, we would fill the void created by the New York Times on this.
Well, I like how David tries to see if he can get me to go rise to the bait, and I could
indeed,
give him—
Indeed, he is aiming for your goat.
Can you imagine? Can you imagine?
And poor goat.
So I'm going to avoid the what's the Sean Spicer temptation to go, take that on, other than to refer you to the many stories we've written about many of these different projects. I think the fundamental question it raises in each of these cases is, What is his ongoing relationship in these places? Because you could do the same thing with Rex Tillerson and every oil deal that ExxonMobil made. You could do the same thing with Wilbur Ross and every deal he struck with his companies before he was Commerce Secretary. You can play that game, and there's lots of good stories
in there.
I don't
know that it's a game. Why would we call it a game? Donald Trump is president of the United States. He still owns this company. His sons run this company. One of his nitwit sons said as recently as a couple of days ago that he's still briefing his father on the financials, of these companies. If the company has an interest, the president has an interest.
That's right. And this is why fundamentally he needed to go do the full divestment, despite all the arguments about how hard it was. And you notice that Wilbur Ross just went and did that. He didn't argue about it. He just divested. And it would be an interesting model for the president to go follow. But the fact of the matter is that the big issue going forward for everybody is in every Donald Trump decision, in every transaction, do you see the shadow of eventual payoff for his businesses when he goes back someday, 4 or 8 years from now, to running the business? And I think that's why, in the end, he's going to come to regret not having done the full divestment, because he's not going to be able to make a major foreign policy decision without that question being raised each and every time.
See, I think there's even a more like fundamental or immediate threat, and that's that I think Donald Trump knows he can't keep this stuff secret. He probably isn't afraid of the New York Times, but now that he's heard David say that foreign policy is going to pick up the mantle and investigate this, he knows for sure.
Could we check? Is he already tweeting on foreign policy?
That he can't hide this, right? I mean, I think on some level, he must recognize that, and that's that should be the thing that colors his attack on our institutions. Because that's the only card he has left to play. Undermine the credibility of the intelligence community. Undermine the credibility of the Justice Department. Undermine the credibility of all the institutions that we have constructed in order to hold the President of the United States accountable. Because I think he knows better than anybody else that this stuff is out there and is the dawning realization that the media is not going away. This story is not going away. Those are the motivation and that's the response. I'm less worried about what he does 4 or 8 years from now. I'm more worried about what he decides to do while he's in office in order to protect himself over the long term.
Corey.
Yeah, I can't improve on what Susan just did.
Wow. Stunned silence.
Stunned. I can't improve.
What's gotten into you, Corey?
It's that California sunshine.
Yeah, it is.
She's mellow.
She's baked. Yeah, as you look at, what Susan was just talking about, and what David was talking about, the suggestion is there that there are a lot of things more than Russia to compromise this president. And I think there is also a sort of cumulative effect that may take a toll on Republicans before it takes a toll on Trump. But, these stories will continue to break. I mean, I don't want to divulge any, deep secrets here, David, but you're an experienced journalist with leading a failing hoax-driven publication.
Enemy of the People.
Gotten a few scoops in his day.
Enemy of the People. Would you anticipate that more such stories will drop in the months ahead?
If they don't, I've been wasting a lot of time sitting in huge numbers of meetings with armies of reporters.
Dun, yeah, dun, dun. That sounds awful, but very promising. But so Corey, the point is, we're just 2 months into this presidency in a lot of ways. We've only had 2 months worth of Trump scandals.
Oh my God, it's only been two.
And we have
months.
Not
so
yet
exhausted.
Even spoken about the one that I think has the biggest potential to be large scale destruction of the Trump presidency, which is the possibility that because of his legal exposure in an incident revealed by former CIA Director Jim Woolsey, that former National Security Advisor Mike Flynn was colluding with the government of Turkey or agents of the government of Turkey to kidnap and without any legal protection, extradite from this country, Fethullah Gulen, to Turkey. The possibility I don't know whether it's true. David, I'd love to know your judgment on whether the likelihood that Mike Flynn could turn state's evidence.
Well, there certainly is a lot of discussion on that subject. And if you think about Mike Flynn, there's something notable about him. First of all, he's the only person on earth who has ever been fired by both Barack Obama and Donald Trump. That actually takes work when you think about it, okay? And we know that when he was fired by the Obama administration, he took it very personally and turned on them. Now, we have not heard him in public yet on what happened with him with the Trump administration, but my guess is he didn't take it so well. And if that's the case, you could imagine a situation in which he could well decide that cooperating with the FBI in return for immunity is his best option. And it strikes me that that could be pretty problematic for the Trump administration or former members of the Trump campaign. We don't know how much he knows, but he certainly seemed to be at the center of most of the big foreign policy decisions from last summer forward.
So he could talk not just about the specifics of a case like the one that Corey is talking about, but also about Trump's involvement in these issues and to what extent he was aware of the Manafort's and the Pages and the Stones and so forth.
Or he could say he was completely unaware of it and this was being done by people who just thought it would help the campaign. We don't know what he has to say. He hasn't said a word since he left the National Security Advisor's office.
Well, so that is also floating out there and could take down the president. But by the way, I mean, you know, there are other things that are there.
We haven't had any external events yet. What strikes me is every problem this team has faced, whether it is health care, the Russia case, the executive orders that came out too quickly and got struck down by the courts, every problem so far has been a self-inflicted wound.
That's a great point, David.
We have not seen – can you repeat that one more time, Corey?
We'll make it your ringtone.
Just so that I can hear
it. We can edit it, by the way, so it sounds like she's saying that to me.
Oh. But we know she wouldn't do that. The real interesting question is, what's the first international crisis that tests whether this team can hold together? Is it North Korea? Maybe. Is it a Russia case? Maybe.
Well, it also may be one of their own creation. One of the things that I find absolutely astonishing is that the United States of America is ramping up its military involvement in the Middle East in a substantial way, has, according to our allies in the Middle East, the Iraqis, changed our rules of engagement in such a way to loosen them that has produced a major spike, uptick in the number of civilian casualties, which, by the way, plays into the hands of extremists in the region, undercuts our allies in the region. He has expanded into Yemen in a way that has not happened so far. You know, it may be, and by the way, we've lost a strategic province in Afghanistan recently. So, you know, it may be that the first international crisis that Trump faces is the perpetual international crisis of the Middle East, wherein his secret plan, in quotation marks, starts blowing up in his face and ours.
But in some ways, you pay less of a price for having something go wrong that went wrong for the previous two presidents.
No, I understand. You were just saying what is going to be external that is going to cause a problem. And I'm just saying I think it's not impossible that activities in the Middle East could cause real problem for this president.
See, I think you guys are both giving the American public like way, way too much credit. The thing that is
They don't listen to this podcast,
right,
so you
like,
can be open.
Yes, like right, to, you know, that they're going to see that there's, you know, the rules of engagement have been loosened. That's going to be the thing that really kind of gets to them. It's going to be something stupid that we know sort of this, you know, this pathological need to push the boundaries on everything. This sort of absence of any kind of discernible morality or character, right? It's gonna be, you know, a sort of a reality TV show style scandal because it's a reality TV show style president, and that's gonna be the thing that like captures the public's attention and wakes them up to say, oh wait, this is not going very well. This is not
you
a
mean,
good
he sort
president.
Of does Real Housewives of New Jersey style, and he like flips a table over on Theresa May at some meal or
you know,
something like that.
Didn't that happen at the Merkel meeting? Yes. I mean, when he presented the alleged bill?
The alleged bill.
Right, but it'll be the same thing that, you know, has sort of felled previous presidents, sort of sexual improprieties, you know, the sort of trying to conceal otherwise less significant crimes. I mean, I think he will ultimately be brought down by something ordinary and sort of more consistent with the character of who he is. I don't see him being held accountable for his failures abroad, which is sad because it's so immensely consequential for people around the world. But I just don't see that
again,
being the thing.
The Hennessy theory would have Euripides and Sophocles doing cartwheels on the front lawn because it's perfectly fitting that his manner of reality TV show governing ends up being what sinks him.
Right. What helps him achieve his goal is what ultimately is his undoing. Also Greek tragedy. Also a classic of Greek
I'm still
tragedy.
Trying to get the idea of Euripides doing cartwheels. I'm not sure I want to see that.
Why is that? Because he's wearing a toga?
Yeah. Please, don't yeah. please don't answer that question. Please don't answer that question.
Yeah. Well, Corey, you're the one who brought the analogy into the conversation.
You're right. I will scold myself.
Yeah, and we're going to call this podcast Euripides Cartwheels. Following the last one, which is tobogganing to Gamora, which Corey is doing an excellent job of appealing to this. And by the way, that'll appeal to our readers because our listeners, they're so weird. You know, this army
you know,
of nerds.
Our 12 listeners.
Our 12. But here's the thing I know about our 12 listeners at this point. None of them have any device in which they can hold their coffee. I'm constantly getting emails from these people saying, you know, my hands are scalded because I lack a simple mug in which to hold my—
I have to say, I love all of them. It makes me smile every time I see one in my Twitter timeline.
Yeah, and there's like 50 a day at this point.
That's because they're on. This is on a Russian bot.
But they are so, they're all—
This is the Russian plan to bankrupt foreign policy.
Wait a minute. You mean there's a ER mug bot out there?
Yes.
There is. And what we actually want an investigation, because if you start charging for these mugs, as you have suggested, we want to know what portion of that revenue is going to the Russian treasury.
None of it. Come at us with your best bots, Russia. We challenge you. No, but actually those ER nerds out there, when they're listening to this stuff, they're like, it's not going to be money or sex or power that'll bring them down. You know, it'll be violation of Section 326.04-C of, you know, some code someplace, because that's the way these nerds think about
it. It's how they think, which is why we love them.
No, it's like Susan's here and she'll quote some federal code and they'll love that. And then Corey will quote some development in the, you know, Tyler administration and they'll like love that. You know, they really, and then David will go off into some kind of, you know, cyber wonderland and get into, you know, nobody will understand him except, you know, him and his therapist. And then that, you know, they love that kind of thing. This sort of simple reality view, TV show view that Susan has expressed is completely over their head. They don't even know what a reality. Corey, have you ever watched a reality television show?
I have not, David.
Never, Corey. You're among friends. Not even one?
No.
The Bachelor?
You know, I feel like I have all the reality I can handle.
The Real Housewives?
No.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, indeed. My sister tells me such things exist.
I would watch a Corey Shockey reality television show.
Wow.
I just want to put that out there into the universe.
That's only because it all takes place in the wine-growing sections of California. And every Corey Shockey reality TV show begins with uncorking a new bottle of some phenomenal wine in the middle of Sonoma.
Unless it takes a dark twist.
Let me just say,
and
my
we
friends,
have Corey,
how much
Let's go on.
Let me just say how much I aspire to be of the general interest you guys even mockingly think possible.
I have this image that you go in at night and there's a room that you keep locked, and you walk into the room and there's four places set at the table, and in three of them there are mannequins dressed as Polk, Tyler, and Henry Clay, and you sit there and you say—
with my imaginary friends, and talk about the 19th century. Now, that actually does sound like my life, David.
Right, exactly. She has her little tea party in 1837.
That's exactly right.
I'll give you the truth. I was out a few weeks ago at Stanford, and every time I would walk in to go raid the coffee machine at the little Hoover, you know, lounge that was there, there was Corey in the corner with another group of adoring grad students surrounding her. And none of them was named Polk, as far as I could tell.
And they just sit there and they say, please autograph my thesis for me.
Yeah,
and
that's it. Or write it.
No, actually, they sit there and say, I don't agree with what you wrote in your foreign policy column. And we have fantastic arguments about it. So I wish they were adoring. Sadly, they are instead incredibly intellectually challenging, which is what makes Hoover such a wonderful place.
Wait a minute. Do you actually accept liberals at Hoover? I thought it was, you know, it was like designed to be the one sort of right-wing outpost of academia producing, you know, sort of right-wing nutcases to go into Republican administrations.
Is that me you're talking about, David?
No. You're very moderate. You're extremely moderate. You're
like
on the list.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how many Make America Great hats do you see in Hoover board meetings each?
Equivalent to the number of reality TV shows I have watched.
Wow. That's
because when those people step off of the Hoover campus, they're in the middle of Stanford, and you might not want to be walking around Stanford with your Make America Great Again hat.
Yeah, but Hoover is a little island of something.
It's true.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
In all of academia, actually.
It's a little island of intellectual seriousness and collegiality that cares about ideas shaping a free society, David.
Wow. I love that. It's very – in fact, a little tear is welling up right here in the corner of my eye as I think about that. But we've got a couple of minutes left to go. David, if you were going to make a bet over the next month as to the next bombshell that's going to drop on the Trump administration – what would it be?
It would be a foreign policy crisis that will take us away from Russia. And that actually has some utility, as you could imagine, for Donald Trump. And I think the first ones to cooperate could well be the North Koreans. I mean, we look at the satellite photographs. You see them wiring up for another nuclear test. I can't tell you if it's going to be the next few weeks, the next few months, or whatever. And right now, you could imagine Donald Trump actually welcoming getting fully engaged in some kind of foreign policy crisis that does not have Russia involved in it, and keep all of the Russia investigations on some other burner.
My prediction is that it will be domestic, because I think that what Donald Trump really has to be worried about after last week's healthcare debacle is that he now has a bunch of congressional Republicans who are not afraid of him anymore. He went in, he stamped his feet, he said that he was going to, you know, there was going to be hell to pay, and you march to the floor and you do your votes, and got, couple hundred middle fingers in response. And so now everybody knows that exactly like the Chinese learned early in his tenure, there's a lot of big talk, but there's not a lot of action to back it up, considering the fact that his Donald Trump's legislative agenda and sort of goals here do not necessarily align with those of the party. I think that he is going to be faced with increasing resistance from his own Congress, and that is going to be sort of the next big shoe to drop, or the big realization, is that he cannot get anything done.
That's a slow burn.
I have a fast burn one, and I think it's the NATO summit. Or it's not a summit. It's a meeting of heads of state, which is somehow magically not a
Thank
summit.
Thank God you cleared that up, Corey. I was going to say.
But as I understand the current plan, there is an appreciation on the part of folks doing the Sherpa work that the president is unlikely to sit through 28 statements by his fellow heads of state and allies who have committed a sacred obligation that that an attack on one of them would constitute an attack on all of them. And so instead of the typical, let's all sit around and talk about what we're worried about at a NATO summit, or instead of the alternative typical NATO summit, which is the United States has proposed a policy initiative for that we're trying to get everybody to sign up to and work together on to strengthen our alliance, that instead the Sherpas are thinking of radically reducing the amount of time that Donald Trump will have to be in a room with his fellow heads of state. And instead, and I'm not making this up, instead take the President of the United States on a tour of the $1.3 billion new NATO headquarters, which is not yet completed, somehow imagining that they could have like a real estate conversation with him and that that would prevent him from sitting in the meeting and tweeting out boring speeches by people who don't pay their fair share.
Which wouldn't be entirely a misrepresentation of a NATO meeting, would it?
Well, the boring part, as far as the pay their fair share part, there is some debate.
I once worked for a boss back in my youth in the American government who had to go to NATO meetings four times a year. And he used to say that the reason NATO exists is to force the United States to sit still and listen to what our allies are worried about.
I think, by the way, that goes to your point, which is that, you know, the idea that Trump can't go and sit still and listen to the allies is not going to endear him to the allies.
Yeah. And he seems to think, as on so many other issues in the Trump administration, they seem to think nobody else gets a vote. And the day has come for every American president where they want the help of countries that share our values, that are economically intertwined to us, that are friends and allies of our country and want to help protect our interests in the world. The day comes where you actually need them. And President Trump's, you know, that it was plausible to so many of us, me included, that Trump would have handed Angela Merkel a bill for $350 billion with compound interest attached, that he's not buying the kind of goodwill that free societies require in order to run risks on each other's behalf.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, you know, to go back to your refrain of bringing up Greek tragedy throughout this discussion, that, you know, it's quite likely that Trump's strength will be his undoing. I don't know that it'll be his reality show strength. I think it's much more likely that it's the other one that Susan was referring to, which is related to it, which is the fact that he's just a bullshit artist. And he's gotten away with a lot of bullshit over the course of his life. But, you know, at a certain point when you're president of the United States, it takes a toll. It takes a toll on your public credibility, but it also takes a toll on your international credibility. And it has consequences that he hasn't had to deal with in his life. And one of those may be European leaders run for office anti-Trump and discover that works for them. And people around the world start saying, oh, no, it's better for me to oppose this guy because he's a buffoon or he's a liar or his views are ridiculous.
Well, we saw this happen during the Bush administration when Europe turned against Bush, and you know that was the end of Tony Blair and others. So I think that's entirely conceivable. I agree with Susan that weakness in Congress is going to be a problem, but at the end of the day, Congress is going to want to think about holding on to its own majority. So I think it's going to be a slow burn. On the NATO side, I think what's going to be interesting to watch is this interesting dance where they send General Mattis, or now Defense Secretary Mattis, and Secretary Tillerson out on his plane, sans all of us from the press, to go say all the right things and sit through all the boring meetings at NATO. And the question at the end of the day will be, do they believe them or do they believe the attitude that President Trump takes when he won't.
Well, there's another thing, you know, which is a potential crisis for Trump. And we are going to wrap up here in just about a second, but I just want to flag it because it could happen fairly soon related to the NATO summit. He hasn't set foot in Europe in a setting where there could be a big demonstration.
So he also hasn't gone back to New York since January 20th, where there also could be a big demonstration.
And you know, I think, you know, it would be very, very embarrassing for the U.S. president to go land in one of these places and have there be a big turnout against him. In any event, we shall see. I promise we will not always dive into these issues, but I felt it was really important this week to get into them in some depth. And we were very, very lucky to have, as frequently we do here, David Sanger of the New York Times, Susan Hennessy of Lawfare and Brookings, well known for its cafeteria around the world.
World-renowned.
World-renowned cafeteria. Corey Shockey of Hoover, which is an island of something in the middle of someplace.
With a lot of coffee.
With a lot of coffee. And Corey, surrounded by admirers, asking for thesis advice. And, you know, they shed a lot of light on this. And I hope you enjoyed the conversation. I certainly did. And we all hope you will join us again soon for another episode of The ER. Thank you very much. You have been listening to Foreign Policy's The ER podcast. I'm David Rothkopf, and I have been your host. The program is produced by Maria Ori with the assistance of Alex Dorr. For more information about FP and to subscribe to the ER and our Global Thinkers podcast, please visit foreignpolicy.com, iTunes, or Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. And thank you very much for joining us.